last time we were talking about the k-means algorithm, and if you remember, k-means is basically the algorithm that you tell it how many populations you want to find, and it drops that many centroids randomly into space, and then it starts iteratively assigning points to the nearest centroid and recomputing the centroids, right? So we went through an example. You have two random centroids, not in very good positions. You color the points based on which one they're closest to, and then you recompute the centroids. And you continue doing that, and centroids are going to move around to a position that has the points clumped up around each centroid as much as possible. We also talked that this is sort of a suboptimal solution. So it finds a local minimum of the total distance from the centroid to the members of the cluster. So you'd want to do this multiple times. And where we left off is we were talking about an application of k-means. So this is a slightly odd application. So it's certainly not the most intuitive thing that I could have come up with. But what I tried to do is I tried to come up with an example of how k-means actually is used in practice. And this is one example that k-means is really used like that for pre-processing the images. So you could imagine simpler cases where, you know, you have maybe you have a collection of documents and you want to figure out, you know, what are the main groups of documents, what are the main topics that are discussed in this collection. So you could imagine applying k-means and then sort of treating each cluster as a major topic of discussion. So maybe all the politics will be in one end, all the news stories will be in another end. In practice, this isn't used very much because you get better results if you just get a little bit of training data and then classify rather than trying to cluster in an unsupervised way. So there's lots of you know, seemingly possible applications of k-means, but it's not used. But this is an example where k-means is actually used in practice. So let's rehash what we were talking about. The basic idea is I want to represent images for the purpose of classifying them, seeing what objects occur in the image. So maybe, you know, whether this is natural scenery or landscapes, whether this contains animals or contains people. And and what you want to do is you want to get away from the pixel-based representation where each attribute is a pixel and get to something a little bit more meaningful. And k-means allows you to do that. So if you take an image, slice it up into a set of patches, and then for each patch, compute some sort of a representation and then cluster those patches so that similar-looking patches will drop into the same cluster. And then you can imagine using the cluster numbers as a representation for that patch. So let's look at an example of what you're actually hoping will happen. So if you have a large collection of images, you are going to slice each image into these little patches. And then what you're doing is you are clustering. You're using k-means on the patches, on each one of those little squares. What you're hoping will happen is that similar looking patches will end up in the same cluster. That's your hope. So in this case, cluster 79, C79. So I'm hoping that will, all the patches that are sort of bluish in hue, bluish in color, and relatively smooth, not very textured, I'm hoping that all of them will plop down in C79. And note, this doesn't mean water or sky. It's anything that's bluish and not textured. So we'll go into that cluster. And sometimes it'll be chunks of water, like in this tiger image or in that tiger image. And sometimes it'll be chunks of sky. And then what I'm hoping is that C14 will contain patches that where the hue is yellowish and blackish, and then there is a certain texture. There is edges at a certain angle, right? So what this will do is, if I have a patch that has a little bit of a tiger skin, maybe it'll go into C14. And it'll be similar to other patches like that. So this, for example, is this is certainly not a tiger. I think it's food of some sort. But it has a similar hue, and it has vertical patches. So it'll probably end up in that, end up being clustered in that with that centroid as well, right? And then greenish textured things maybe will go into C27. So that's what I'm doing. I'm taking a large collection of images and clustering the individual patches, right? And how do I use that then? What I do then is, in my next step, when I actually want to classify the images, I use those cluster numbers as a representation for an image. So if I got an image like this, instead of using pixels as attributes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, oh, look, I got a bunch of patches here, and they all fall into C79. Now, I don't know that C79 is sky, and it's not sky. It's just a cluster that has bluish solid things. But this will be useful because another image that contains a bunch of C79s, that tells me something. That tells me that that image has a bunch of patches that are similar to this image. And that's how you know that it's a decent representation. And then the grassy things, the green grassy things, those patches will probably go into C27, and you will you'll say that this image contains a bunch of C27. So after doing that, your representation for an image is going to look like that. So it has four instances of C14, seven instances of C27, and 24 instances of C79, and then. Zero of every other cluster, however many clusters you have. And this, we've seen that representation before. This is a bag of words representation. This is what we used for text. We're counting how many times each one of those labels occurs in this image. So this is a trick that allows you to take something like a bitmap and convert it to something like text. And it's a very effective trick. You end up with a representation that's compact, order invariant. It doesn't matter where the sky and the tiger are, right? It's just looking at the counts of the tiger patches and the counts of the sky patches and the counts of the grass patches. So it's order invariant. It's very compact. It's discrete, which means that if you're going to be measuring distances, you can do it very quickly, because for sparse data, for word-like data, we have very fast methods of computing distances. So this is a very attractive representation, and it keeps the visual appearance. So if you have two images that are similar in visual appearance, they will be similar in terms of these counts, because patches will fall into the same clusters, and you will have the same C14 with a positive count in one image and a positive count in another image. So similar things will have similar representations, and that's really what we want. So it's a nice way to transform images into a discrete representation, and this is actually used in practice. So people use it for annotating images and sort of constructing a compact representation, which you can then learn something based on. All right. So let's summarize. We're talking about clustering, k-means clustering specifically. So the task that we're doing is unsupervised. We're not trying to predict anything specific. With k-means, the task is you're given k groups, and you're supposed to sort the items into k clusters. The model structure is you have k clusters. For each cluster, you have a centroid. Centroid is a d-dimensional vector. The scoring function we talked about, it tries to optimize the average distance from each instance to the centroid of the cluster that it falls into. And we talked about that it's not a global optimum. It's a local optimum. And the optimization method is iterative. So it iteratively assigns points to clusters and then recomputes these representations. Okay, so a couple of last words for k-means. What you use it for is you use it to sort of discover, if you know how many populations you want in your data, you can discover what those populations might be. It's a fast method. It's probably the fastest out of the ones that we're going to discuss, except possibly for KD trees. It converges to a minimum, but it's a local minimum. It's a minimum of the distance function. So if you do it in practice, if you have enough computational resources, you probably want to run it multiple times from random init points. How do you pick k if you don't know k? Well, so really the best way is to use that plot, the scree plot, and to look for a point that looks like a good point to stop. There's really no better way. And one thing to keep in mind is this method doesn't guarantee that two nearby points are going to end up in the same cluster. So this, we talked about, this is a stable configuration and there's no way to get out of this. That's why you need to run it multiple times. we talked about the image representation. Right? So it's and this is actually something that's used in practice. All right, so I'm going to switch and talk about Gaussian mixtures now. And before I do that, any questions about k-means? Okay. So let's talk about mixture models. there's many different ways to talk about this topic, and what I like to think about is I like to come at it from the standpoint of how it is similar to k-means and how it's different from k-means. Because if you squint at it hard enough, you'll realize that Gaussian mixture models with EM are actually just a better version of k-means, and they're not that far off. And the big substantial difference between them is in how they treat the assignment of points to clusters. Right? K-means is a hard clustering method. So a point either falls into cluster number one or into cluster number two, and it can't fall into both of them. Mixture models are by definition soft methods. So a point doesn't belong to one of the mixture components. So it's not going to belong to one of the clusters. It's going to have an affinity, a measure of probability that it falls into one cluster and another cluster. And so it's actually going to be a member of all the clusters, just with different weights, different confidences. Mixture models, it's a probabilistically grounded way of doing soft clustering with a fixed number of components. And what you're imagining when you're doing mixture models is you're imagining that you have data points falling at you, but behind, somewhere behind the scenes, these data points are generated from a number of sources. So there are k different sources somewhere, you don't see them, and what happens is at each time step, one of the sources spits out an observation, and that observation goes into a pipe, and then I see it. I don't know which of the sources produced that observation, and I don't know what the sources look like. I just see the observation. And my goal is to recover that picture that's behind the scenes. So I'm going to try to figure out which point came from which data source, and also what each data source looks like. And what it looks like, because I'm doing it probabilistically, each data source is going to take a form of a probability distribution, which can spit out certain types of samples. So if I'm dealing with numbers or vectors of numbers, my samples must come from something that generates vectors of real numbers. So typically that would be a Gaussian. So I imagine that somewhere behind the scenes there is a number of Gaussians, and somebody sort of decides, well, I'm going to use this Gaussian now, generate a number or a vector from that Gaussian, and send it down the pipe. If I have discrete observations, if I'm seeing words, then I'll probably want to use something other than a Gaussian. So I might use a Bernoulli distribution, which generates sets, right, effectively, what words are present or absent. Or I might use a multinomial distribution that generates words with counts, so multisets or bags. and each of the sources, it's represented by a set of parameters. So for Gaussian, you have the mean and the variance if it's a single number, or the covariance matrix if it's a multidimensional Gaussian. for the multinomial, this would be a vector of probabilities, one for each of the words. And what my goal is, when I'm trying to figure out what the sources look like, my goal is to recover these parameters of all the k Gaussians based on the points that I see falling down the pipe. And the way you do that is through an EM algorithm, which sort of magically discovers everything for you. I find it useful to start talking about EM from a quick example. Now, suppose that somebody gave me a set of points. Now, this is an example in 1D, so these are just points on a line, right? Just numbers. So if I have this set of points, and if somebody went in and told me these 5 points came from a blue source, and these 5 points came from a yellow source, right? So if I have two sources, a blue and a yellow, if somebody told me which point comes from which source, then it's very easy for me to reconstruct what the sources look like. Right? So in this case, I'm assuming that the sources are Gaussian. I know there's only two of them, and I have a few examples from each one of them. So how do we do that? Well, it's really pretty simple. So if I want to I have a blue Gaussian and a yellow Gaussian. A Gaussian in one dimension is defined by two numbers, the mean and the variance, right? So I just need to compute the mean and the variance. So if I compute the mean, how could I do that? Well, I just take all the blue numbers, add them up, and divide by the number of blue balls, blue points that I have. Right? So that's just the mean. You do the same thing for the variance, and those together give you enough to draw a Gaussian. Right? So if somebody told me which point came from which source, I can reconstruct the parameters quite easily. And I guess another parameter that I would need in a mixture model is also the prior. You know, with what probability does somebody pick that Gaussian versus another Gaussian? So the priors could be equal, but they don't have to be equal. And the way you would do that is you would take the MB, the number of blue points, and divide it by the total number of points that you had. That would be it. Right? In this case, the priors could be equal. So we've all seen that. That's trivial. So it's trivial because somebody told us what the sources are. Now, if you get a bunch of points, but nobody tells you which source they came from, it's a little bit harder. Right? So I got a bunch of points here, and I know they must have come from two sources, but which one came from which source? So that's the problem that you really have to solve when you're doing mixture models. You get a bunch of points, and you're told that there are two sources, two Gaussians for them. But how do you estimate the parameters? And it's kind of difficult. Well, you know, if I only had to fit one, that would be trivial, right? But one is not very interesting. I really want to do two. I really want to separate them. So it's hard. But if somebody actually told me the parameters of the two Gaussians, that would give me something, right? So if somebody said that I have a blue Gaussian that looks kind of like that, and a yellow Gaussian that looks kind of like that, then based on this, I can reconstruct which point belongs to each Gaussian. Not exactly, but I can get some estimate. So I know that these points probably came from the blue one because they're closer to the blue one, and these ones probably came from the yellow one because they look like they came from the yellow one. And how would I do that formally? The way you would do that is for each point, you would compute what are the chances that that point is a sample from a given Gaussian distribution. So take the data point, subtract the mean, square it, divide it by the variance, raise it to that, and normalize, right? So this is the density of Fxi for the blue Gaussian. This is sort of, if you imagine sampling from the blue Gaussian lots and lots of times, this is how often you would get Xi within a certain interval. Right. And then I can take this number and use Bayes rule to figure out the probability that the point is really came from the blue Gaussian. And that's just you look at those generative probabilities from there and multiply them by the priors. And that would allow you to color the points. That would allow you to say these points probably are blue, and these points probably are yellow. Now, it's not the same coloring that I had in there, but it's pretty good. It's pretty decent. So what you have is a chicken and egg problem of sorts. If somebody told you the parameters of the Gaussian, of each Gaussian, you could figure out which point came from which source. But nobody tells you the parameters. Now, if somebody told you which point came from which source, estimating the parameters is trivial. But again, nobody tells you that. So you have two unknowns, but if you knew one, you could get the other one really easily. So that's what the EM algorithm is based on, the expectation maximization. The basic idea there is to start with crappy estimates for the parameters of each source, and with crappy estimates of which point came from which source, and to iteratively use them to improve each other. Right? So you start with crappy Gaussians, randomly placed Gaussians with a random mean and a random standard variance, and you use them to color the points. And then once you've colored the points, you use the new colors to re-estimate the mean and the variance. And that's sort of EM in a nutshell. And we'll go through an example that goes into a little more detail. So what does it look like? When I'm coloring the points, remember this is probabilistic, it's soft clustering. So I'm not saying this point is blue or yellow, I am assigning a degree of color to it. And that degree of color is the posterior probability. So in this case, it would be the probability that it came from the blue given whatever number xi really wants. So this is a number between 0 and 1, and if it was exactly 1, you would say, okay, for sure it came from the blue. If it was exactly 0, then for sure it came from the yellow. But it can also be in between, so it can be 50-50. And then based on these numbers, I'm going to adjust the mean and the variance. And I'm going to repeat this procedure many times until it actually converges to something useful. So let's look at an example of what happens with this in 1D. So I start with a set of points. The points are not colored. I don't know which point came from which source. What I do is I place two Gaussians with random means and random variances somewhere in the space. And what I'm doing here is I'm sort of placing them in one corner. That's basically the, so that makes it hard for 1D. So it's not random, but it's sort of a bad case. Now, what am I going to do next? I have these random Gaussians. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try to figure out for each one of these points, did it come from the blue one, or did it come from the yellow one? Or more accurately, what is the probability that it came from the blue one? How do I do that? Well, it's simple. I have the mean of the blue Gaussian. I have the standard deviation of the blue Gaussian. So I can compute the density at that point, and that gives me sort of an estimate for the probability of how often that point xi would come if I kept sampling from the blue Gaussian. So you would imagine that for all of these points, it would be a fairly small number, but that's all right. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to compute this estimate for the blue Gaussian, compute a similar estimate for the yellow Gaussian, and plug them into Bayes' rule with the priors. So PB and P of A, so I guess A represents yellow, I can't spell. In this case, I guess I'm just assuming that the priors are equal for now. So for each one of the points, I'm going to look up, I'm going to try to figure out, is it, you know, what is the probability that it came from the blue one? So for example, let's look at this point. Right? This point, it's very far from the blue mean, and the blue has a fairly tight variance. So the density for this point, given the blue Gaussian, is going to be very small. But the density for this point, given the yellow Gaussian, is going to be even smaller. So once I plug those numbers into Bayes' rule, the posterior probability that it's blue, it's going to be quite high. It's going to be almost, you know, it's going to be near to one. So it's a it's a crappy sample from each other one, but it's a lot less likely to be yellow than it is to be blue. So this line represents the posterior. So this is what P of B given X would look like if I plotted it for every possible value of X. So points that are very far on the right, they're almost certainly blue. And something like this point over there, right, it has a certain probability of coming from the blue Gaussian, but it's actually a lot closer to the yellow. So you imagine that for this point, the probability that it goes with a blue source is less than 50%, less than 0.5. So that looks substantially less. Okay? So now that's the idea. I repeat this process for every one of the points that I have. And this number, the posterior probability that it's blue, I basically use it as a color. So now what I'm gonna do is that's the probability that it's blue, this is the probability that it's yellow. And now I can color the points with soft colors. So the points that are very far to the right, I'm sure that they came from the blue source. The points that are around here, I'm really not sure if they're blue or yellow, but this one is a bit more yellowish and this one is a bit more bluish. Okay, so now what I have is I have an initial coloring of the points. What I can do now is I can take these colors and re-estimate the parameters of both Gaussians. So I can recompute the mean, I can recompute the variance of each one of them. And let's see what that would do. So if I take the blue one, right, most of the points that are colored blue are way out here. So what that's gonna do is that means that the mean has to shift somewhere around here. And also the variance of the blue Gaussian has to increase a lot to cover all of these points that are covered blue. Right? Now the blue Gaussian essentially has to cover all of the points, almost. So what's gonna happen at the next iteration, when I compute, oh, by the way, I guess I haven't told you how you compute the mean. This is the formula that you use. And now let's sort of dig into it and see what it's doing. What I'm doing is I'm summing up over all the points, not just the blue points, right? This is soft clustering. There is no blue and yellow. So we have n data points. We're going to take the value of each data point. We're going to multiply it by the probability that that point goes into the blue cluster and normalize by the sum of the of everything that goes into the blue cluster. So this is, in effect, a prior. This is related to a prior for blue. Okay. So if this is confusing, one very simple way to think about this is think about the relation to k-means. What if this were a hard clustering technique? Right? So if this was a hard clustering technique, then bi would either be 0 or 1. Right? If the point is blue, then it's a 1. If the point is not blue, then it's a 0. So if you imagine sticking 1s and 0s in here, what you're going to have at the top is you're going to multiply all the points that are not blue, you're going to multiply them by 0. So that effectively throws them away from the summation. And what you're left with is only the points that are blue. So you're going to add them all up and divide by the number of blue points. So this thing at the bottom, if b's were 0 or 1, this would be the number of blue points. And you do the same thing for the yellow. So if I did it for the yellow, then most of the a's, I guess, would be 0, because most of the points aren't yellow. So I would just take a couple of them that are yellow and divide by the small number that they are, and that would give me the mean. Okay. Now, that's if I had hard boundaries. I don't. I have soft boundaries. So these numbers, they are they're not just 0 and 1. They can be numbers in between. So what I'm doing is I'm adding up all the values, x1, x2, all the way up through xn. But I'm giving each one of them a weight. And that weight tells me how associated that point is with the blue cluster. So in this case, all of these numbers will have weights of 1. But this one will have some weight. It's going to be a lot less than one, but well, I guess not that much less. But, all of these points would sort of contribute their total value, and this one would contribute a little bit less, and this one would contribute just a little bit to the value of the mean. So that's the way to interpret the update equation. So this is how you compute the mean. This is how you compute the variance, and then you do the same thing for the yellow Gaussian, right? And for the yellow one, it's only these two points that would count, and really this one will have most of the weight, and this one will have a little bit of weight. So what do you expect will happen? The blue Gaussian should really shift to the right. Its mean should get all the way over here, and its variance should become large to cover all of those points. And the yellow Gaussian, you don't expect it to move much, because it's really just this, the first point, that affects the parameters. So you expect that the mean will move to this point, maybe a little bit to the right, and the variance won't change all that much, because it's really just one point that's covered yellow, and this one will add just a little bit of weight to it. Okay. So what should happen is something like this. So the blue Gaussian will move to cover the blue points, the yellow Gaussian will stay to cover the yellow points. And what you do at the next iteration is you repeat the whole thing. Now that I have two new Gaussians, I can recolor my points using the same AI and BI, only using the new means. So now blue has a new mean. That means mean density for all the points. That means that the posterior probability of a point being blue is going to change. So if I draw this sort of, this is almost like a decision function. It tells you how blue or how yellow something is. That function is going to be a lot more stretched out now, right? So more points will get a shade of yellow, and you keep iterating. So you color the points, and then you take the new colors, you re-estimate the parameters of the Gaussians, and you keep doing that until convergence. So what would happen, well, what you hope for is in the end, it'll do something like this, where one Gaussian will travel to one clump of points, and the other one will stay over the other clump. Yes? Yes, yeah, you're right. So there's only two means. Sorry. So in this formula, everything should be a mu of b, because you're talking about the blue mean. Yes, and same thing here. So this should be a mu of b, and this should be a mu of a. Well, okay, so I guess that's the next point. Up until now, I was assuming that the priors are equal. You can actually re-estimate the priors at each step. So if you add up all the b's and you divide them by n, you get the prior for the b Gaussian. And again, the way to interpret that is think about the b's being 0 or 1. So if I have sort of blue or yellow, then this quantity total number of points that were assigned to the blue source. So you're just taking the number of blues, dividing by the total number, and that gives you the prior. The only difference is b's are numbers between 0 and 1, so every point counts just to various degrees. Now, and the prior for a is just 1 minus the p of b. Now, if you did it in this case, this might not actually work out. Because of the way the Gaussians were placed individually, what would happen at this step is the prior for B would become very large. also effectively, effectively the yellow calcium wouldn't have much weight at all. So it's unclear if in the next iteration it would actually overcome that. So if you initially place things pathologically, it might never get out. Okay, so that was an example in 1D. What does it look like when you have more than one attribute in your instances? So suppose we have D attributes. We have K different sources. Each source is a Gaussian, K-dimensional Gaussian. So what you're doing pictorially, you have points in some D-dimensional space. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to fit a number of Gaussian bumps to those points. So each Gaussian, again, has a mean, that's the center of the bump. It has, instead of the variance, it has a covariance matrix. And the covariance matrix tells you how peaked or wide the Gaussian is, but also how is it oriented. Because as soon as you have two or more dimensions, if it's non-spherical, it can actually have different orientations, and you need a matrix to capture that. So that's what you're trying to do, and the algorithm is exactly the same, only the update equations are a little bit more complicated. So for computing the priors, it's the same equation as we had previously. So this P of C given Xi, this is the posterior, given the point Xi, what is the chance that it came from the C, from source C? So you add up those chances over all the data points, you divide by n, and that gives you the prior for source C. For the mean, same update. So what I'm showing here now is this is the mean of source C, and this is the jth attribute of that mean. Now remember, each mean is a vector, and it has d different components. So this is the jth coordinate of that mean. And how do you update that? Well, you add up over all the data points in your data set. You take the jth coordinate, the jth dimension. Basically, to relate it to the previous slide, it's Vi divided by some. That's all it is. So it's related to the posterior, to the prior. So that is our Vi. That tells us how well associated for the covariance matrix, it's just a little bit more complicated. You have the same weight, but what you're doing, so now you don't just have, you don't have a vary, for the mean, you have just one number per dimension. That's the mu along the jth dimension. For the covariance, you have the jth dimension and the kth dimension, and you have to say how, effectively, how correlated they are in the points that seem to be colored with C color.
So the way you do that is you have the same weight, but you take the difference between the J attribute and the mu, which is C, and the K attribute and the mu. The K attribute and the mu for the source C.
Yeah, right. So this is actually. This is the same as the regular covariance. When we talked about covariances, it's the same equation. The only difference is you have this weighting factor slapped on top of them, whereas before you just had one of them. That's really the only difference. And all of this is, so these are their data equations for the parameters, and all of this is based on the posteriors. And posteriors, we compute using Bayes' rule, so this is a generalized version now. I don't have just two sources. I have k different sources. So in the bottom, I have a summation over k sources. And each one of the generative probabilities, p of xi, now a vector given c, is just a two-dimensional Gaussian. Variance matrix in the middle. So this is what it expands out to, sort of in terms of normal summations. When do we stop the iteration? So it's the, do I talk about that? No, I don't. So as you can imagine, so what makes this different from k-means? In k-means, we had a fixed point when the points don't change colors, right? Here, because the numbers are not 0 and 1, there is no notion of the points stopping changing colors. You have these degrees of blue and yellow, and those degrees are going to keep changing the longer you go. So typically what you do is you set, if you don't have very much data, then you set an epsilon on the changes, and you run the procedure only for as many iterations as, you run the procedure until the changes in the mean and the covariance are above the epsilon. And as soon as they become smaller than the epsilon, you stop. If you have lots of data, then as with k-means, you run it for as many iterations as you have the time for. Absolutely. So. It's the same as k-means. So if you look at it, what I did is I presented it from a hand-wavy point of view, sort of an intuitive. If you try to figure out what happens mathematically, what this is trying to do is this is trying to optimize the joint likelihood, log likelihood of the data, given a mixture model. So the mixture model is you have k components, look at basically you average the probability of drawing the point from each one of the components subject to the priors. So that's what it's trying to optimize. Depending on what this function is, depending on what model you're using, this objective function probably has local minima. Local maxima, I'm trying to maximize likelihood. So depending on where you start, you will end up in a different local maximum. It's the same thing as with k-means, really. So the two techniques are very, very similar. They do effectively the same thing. The only difference is k-means, it makes a hard decision. Yep, it's yellow, nope, it's blue. This one doesn't make a hard decision. It says, well, it's kind of yellowish, but there's also a chance that it's blue. And it keeps those weights throughout the procedure. But underneath, it's really doing a very similar thing. So it has local maxima, and depending on where you start, you will get into a different local maximum. So if you want the global one, then you run it multiple times. It's the same thing as with k-means. So that's what it's trying to do. It's trying to maximize the likelihood. So you have the same questions that we had with k-means. So for example, how do we pick k? Because you have a notion of likelihood, you might be tempted to say, well, let's maximize the likelihood. So let's pick k that gives the highest possible likelihood for the data. The same unfortunate thing will happen that happened with k-means. The likelihood is maximized when k equals to n, right? In general, now there are local maximums, so you're not guaranteed that with each random configuration that will happen. But in general, it happens that the more components you give it, the better likelihood it's going to be able to give you. So, you know, effectively what it wants to do is it wants to place a little Gaussian on top of each one of the data points. And then what happens if it can do that, if it has enough Gaussians to place on top of each one of the data points, it'll then work to shrink the variances to zero. Right? So if you imagine that for each data point you have its own little source, now you want to make that you want to make the points as probable as possible given that source. So what it'll do is it'll start shrinking this bump until it turns into a spike. So if you keep it running, you'll end up with a set of spikes placed over the points of your data. Okay, so this won't this won't work really well, and as you can imagine, this actually, so this is a generative model. It describes a probability distribution over data. So one thing you can use it for, once you fit the Gaussians, you can if somebody gives you a new data point, you can ask a question: well, how probable is that data point given that model of the sources? So you just plug it into that equation. Xi would be your new data point. And if you imagine that if you let it converge to a set of spikes, what's going to be the probability for a new data point? Zero, right? Because it's going to be, you know, it's not going to fit under any of the spikes because the spikes are, you know, they're not very broad at the base. So this won't work very well. What can you do? Well, you can try to play the same trick with the training and validation sets. So you can take your data, split it into two parts, use the training portion to estimate the Gaussians, and then use the validation set to pick the number of Gaussians, k. So what you're hoping for is you're hoping to find the number of Gaussians that generalizes best between between the training set and the validation set, and this works better than than it did for k-means, but it's by no means it's by no means bulletproof. There is another way to pick k in this case, and that has to do with the fact that now we're talking about probabilities, so we actually have a bit of semantics to grab onto. When we were talking about clustering, the only thing that we had is distances. Right? Now we actually have probabilities, and when you talk about probabilities, you can talk about lots of other things, like information, or entropy, or sort of encoding and bits, and it's a lot more natural when you have probabilities than when you have distances. So there's a couple of ways that are sort of proposed in the literature for picking the optimal k. All of them involve comparing the value of the likelihood to the number of parameters in your system. So if L is the value of that likelihood and P is the number of parameters in your system, you have a couple of criteria that allows you to sort of pick the best. So most of them involve a simple algebraic combination of the likelihood and the number of parameters. So here, you know, take the number of parameters, multiply by 2, subtract the likelihood, and then try to make that as small as possible given the number of parameters over the number of parameters in your system. Yeah. Okay, so parameters. A mean is a parameter. A variance is a parameter. A prior is a parameter. Now, if I have two-dimensional space, then I have two means for each Gaussian, and I have three values in the covariance matrix. So not four, because one of them is trimmed, right? So that would be my total number of parameters, and I would also have one prior. The number of priors depends on the number of classes that you have. So this P is supposed to represent the total number of parameters in the system, and the intuition there is the more parameters you have, the more complex model you are proposing for your data. And what you want to do is you want to keep the model as simple as possible, subject to it fitting the data, right? So the likelihood is important because you want those Gaussians to reflect what your data looks like. So, but subject to it fitting the data, you want to have as few parameters as possible. You want to have as simple a model of the data as possible. All right, we're out of time, so I'll stop here. I'm sorry?
Support vector machines?
Yeah, sure.
Is it sorry, just change the topic.
No, that's fine.
With missing data, when a support vector machine gets
missing data.
With missing data, yeah. How does it deal with that data?
It can't.
It can't at all, right?
Like no, it can't.
Will the point, will like sort of the actual points just be disregarded?
Well, that actually depends on the implementation.
Okay.
So there is no good way to deal with missing data in an SVM.
Okay.
So what you have to do is you either fill in the missing data or you throw away the point. A better solution is to fill in.
Okay.
Because you don't know how, you know, you really don't know how much missing data you have and you don't want to throw everything away.
Okay.
So now how it fills in, this is highly, you know, and I don't know what Weka does, but I'm pretty sure that it fills in.
Okay, good. That makes sense. Okay, cool. Thanks.
Sure.
Excuse me. Where do we get the prior from in the mixture models?
Where do you get the prior from?
So I've seen that there are this P of V and P of A in this formula for this probability of I'm going to guess and. Yeah, but we need to know them in advance to perform the step, right?
Oh, you start with uniform priors.
With uniform, but in this case, why do we are these points classified as yellow? I mean, we have more the probability of them being yellow is higher than being blue if this graph doesn't imply that. I mean, it seems that the probability of the points being blue is higher because at least the priors are equal.
Well, so the example sort of assumes that the priors are equal, but you don't have to. You can actually
but in this case, is it for equal priors? Because I don't think so. In this formula, if priors are equal, the points is classified just to the class for which this value of the Gaussian at this point is higher. Isn't it like that?
Well, okay, right.